And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. Been gone for a week up in Fairbanks. It's cold up there, folks. Actually, winter up there. So, yeah, it's raining down here, but at least it's not snowing yet. Scattered rain showers are in the forecast for the rest of today. Highs around 42 degrees and rain showers in the forecast tonight. Then, snow showers late. I spoke too soon. Snow accumulation tonight up to an inch, mainly in the valley. And rain showers, though, again tomorrow, so it'll get rid of that snow. We've got a really fun show today. Robin Gray Davis is in the studio with us. We talked to him just a second about a workshop for storytellers coming up this weekend. The Grindhouse Liberation Film Festival. That's a UAS Halloween event. We'll be talking to students and a teacher from the English 111 class out there. Bob Tkach is going to be a speaker this week for the JWAC speaking event, and we'll be talking to him. Also, Wildlife Wednesday. Kate Savage from NOAA will be here, and we're going to be talking to folks from Alaska Powder Descent. They've got a film showing happening tomorrow, the TGR film premiere. Becky Janes and Rylan Bell will be here. I'm Andy Klein, and this is going to be a Juno Afternoon. We're going to get to National Native News in just a second.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez in Anchorage, Alaska. Youth are asked to foster an appreciation of Native values at the 2012 Elders and Youth Conference. Philip Charette, a Yupik artist and a youth coordinator, encouraged youth Tuesday to look within their heritage to find knowledge and understanding.
We all, as Native people, have a very, very high degree of spatial orientation and high degree of intelligence. And I remember my grandfather being just so extremely intelligent. And, you know, he was an engineer. He designed things and did things that were just amazing. And, you know, and that intelligence really comes out in a lot of different ways. For example, like in the harpoon heads that we use, the traditional harpoon heads, they're designed for hunting, and they've been used for literally hundreds, if not thousands of years. There was a gentleman who was using a Cray supercomputer to try to do a better harpoon head than what the Native people had developed, and he couldn't do it.
Charette says there are 10 values that guide Native people, which youth should embrace. They include respecting elders, taking care of yourself, and knowing who you are. The Elders and Youth Conference wraps up today in Anchorage. Great Lakes area tribes are upset over Wisconsin's wolf hunting season, which began this week. Mike Simonson has more.
Rusty Barber says wolves are their brothers. The Lacouture Tribal Council member believes wolves and the Anishinaabe people lead parallel lives. That includes forcing wolves off their own land and government-sponsored genocide.
That happened to the Anishinaabe, and it also happened to our brother, the wolf. When we have a hunt like this wolf hunt, things are going to happen within these packs. There's no determining who is the alpha male or the leader of that pack.
Barber says without the leader, the pack could perish. He says the differences between tribes and non-Native people is also hunting for harvesting versus hunting for fun. Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Director Jim Zorn says the wolf population isn't large enough to sustain a hunting season.
From the tribal perspective, the proof is in the pudding, that there's still a level of hunt that's taking place that's unacceptable to the tribes. To that extent, I'm not sure the tribes feel that their views were fully respected or taken into account.
The state has agreed to keep the wolf hunt off tribal land, but they will be able to kill wolves in the surrounding ceded territory. Department of Natural Resources Land Division Administrator Kurt Thiede says the state must have responsible wolf population management.
We continue to respect that, you know, there's the cultural significance that the wolf holds for the Native American peoples, so we're hoping to move forward in a respectful, meaningful way.
The Wisconsin wolf season runs until the end of February. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson in Superior, Wisconsin.
A public meeting held on the Wind River Reservation this week has presented preliminary results on cancer rates. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports.
The Rocky Mountain Tribal Epidemiology Center initiative aims to assess environmental risks on the reservation and develop remediation strategies. Communities on the Wind River Reservation complained of high cancer rates. Folo Akintan directs the Epidemiology Center and says they distributed surveys on the reservation and in communities immediately surrounding it and reviewed national and local data going back up to 50 years. The current update is not conclusive, but Akintan says she has analyzed some of the data, and cancer rates do appear to be high.
Concerns about cancer are quite true, and I just wanted to let them know that I did not think that it's a fallacy or it's a myth, and I would show them that in the statistics.
She says it's too early to say whether health issues in the community can be linked to uranium contamination in the region. She hopes to finish collecting and analyzing the data in the next 6 months before presenting a final report. For National Native News, I'm Irina Zhorov.
During this month in 2010, Hopi code talker Rex Puyoma died. He was one of 10 Hopi men who used their native language to send messages during World War II. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
The great storyteller, Slick Rick. We've got another great storyteller and teacher of storytelling here in the studio with us, Roblin Gray Davis. Roblin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having
me. Roblin, you're an actor and a teaching artist, and I think a lot of people have known you from your performances. I just got to see you in Of Mice and Men. Congratulations on that great production. That was really a wonderful production. But you're teaching a workshop for people who are interested in the kind of art and in improving storytelling. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, this Saturday from 9 to 1, a nice 4 hours to look at the material of local storytellers, anyone who has been writing their own stories or someone who just wants to work on becoming a better storyteller as a performer can use someone else's story and come on in.
Oh, so you're expecting people to come in and bring in things they've worked on and bring in things that they're either in the process of working on or have done, and you can look at that and think about ways to think about it differently and improve it and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm asking to bring in 5 to 7 minutes of material. It can be part of a story, or it could be, like, I think the mud rooms here are about 7 minutes. So if you have material from that or you're thinking about doing that, you could bring that material in. And it's just, it's a workshop for massaging that material and kneading it and finding what's really essential and important in the story for you, but primarily looking at how can you bring your story to life through basic things, body language, a great strong stage presence, a variation in vocal tone and quality. All of that stuff we'll be looking on and sharing our stories with each other.
Is there a common misperception that people have about when they think, okay, I'm going to tell a story? Is there something that people kind of just, you know, who haven't done it a lot before make a common mistake right out of the gate?
Probably lots.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't want to pinpoint any one thing down, because what I like to do is look at individual performers, individual storytellers, and also the stories themselves, the material, the ideas, the themes in a story really dictate how it can be told, or what's the best way to tell that. So looking at the dynamics of rhythm and emotional tone really depends on the performer, I think, and also the material. So I wouldn't say there's only one right way to tell any story. It really is rooted in the individual storyteller. And so part of this workshop will be discovering our own unique idiosyncrasies and how those can be advantages or disadvantages as a performer in front of an audience.
Is your focus more on that, on the performing end of it, rather than the kind of writing end of it? Is that fair to say?
Yes, though we hopefully will have the opportunity, depending on how many people show up and how much material we have to go through, we'll look at a little bit of the writing or giving each other suggestions as far as what really feels like it's working, maybe what isn't working in the writing of the piece. Because, of course, in the writing, a lot of the life and a lot of the story dynamics are written in the text. So we'll be looking at the flow of that and the build of that and maybe it'll bring up questions about the writing for the storyteller. If it's their own material.
Are you seeing a resurgence in storytelling? It seems to me like there is this really great resurgence in people wanting to, in an oral presentation, tell stories.
Yeah, and what is there better than getting in a room together and talking and sharing ideas, sharing stories from our life? It's so magical. That's really how I got into live theater and why I'm interested in doing live performance, because there's just a fantastic, magical quality when we all get in a room together and we share stories.
Yeah, there's just what is it? There's something about it that's really interesting. Do you find stories, the people that you're dealing with this workshop, is it typically things that are people are telling that are truthful from their life, or are there completely fictional accounts that come up as well? And what would be the difference in how you would present those two things?
Well, let me say that for this particular workshop, you know, any material is welcome. How truthful it is or how fictional it is does not matter. And any level of writing and any level of performance, everyone is welcome, from young adults up to old adults, but anyone is welcome to come to this particular workshop with whatever material you have. What was your question?
Well, just the difference between a true story and a fictionalized story,
yeah,
and how you might approach that in the performance end of it.
Well, you know, life is very theatrical, but the theater and performance is, in a sense, extra ordinary. So there has to be a theatrical performance element for the performer. The material itself, it's always interesting because even in our own memories of experiences that we have, we shape those memories through the stories of you know, how we experienced it and also just what we remember from it, which may actually be very different from the truth.
Yeah, right.
But and so I don't know. I always find that there's a great blend. And how much is rooted in your private, personal life, you know, it really depends on the person and the story. But even our imaginative and fictional work, that really is a part of us as well. So I don't know, where is that line between truth
right.
and fiction?
Have you done these workshops before?
Just a few specifically for storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the work that I do in teaching acting and teaching physical theater applies to storytellers as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a much more intimate, a much more personal journey for the performer when it's their own stories or when it's one person in front of an audience.
Yeah. Tell me the nuts and bolts one more time here. That's happening Saturday, right?
This Saturday, yes, October 20th from 9 a.m. We're going to get up early and warm up and tell stories. I guess it's not that early, but it's early in the morning to get up and get over to the Douglas Public Library. It's a free workshop. It's from 9 to 1 this Saturday.
Happening, and Roblin Gray Davis will be teaching it. Roblin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Andy.
That's the workshop for storytellers, and it's happening starting at 9 a.m. this Saturday. Great song there called "The Last Race." That's Jack Nietzsche. You might remember that from Death Proof, which was part of the Grindhouse release that Quentin Tarantino did with Robert Rodriguez a few years back. And there's a Grindhouse Liberation Film Festival coming up, and we got some folks in the studio with me right now. Danielle Griffin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And we've got, tell me a little bit about this idea, Grindhouse Liberation Film Festival. It's happening Saturday at the Egan Lecture Hall out at UAS.
Yeah, well, the Grindhouse, of course, was the type of theater that people used to frequent a lot in the 70s and 80s that were really sleazy and, you know, just... The lowest
course
of the type of movies you could ever imagine.
And kind of
there.
A C budget sort of level as far as budgeting goes.
Grade Z, I think, is the technical term.
A lot of girls behind bars.
Yeah.
Right?
Women in Prison was a really popular one.
A lot of car wrecks and car chases.
Car
kind
wrecks,
of things.
Car chases, yeah. And the most interesting thing to me about the Grindhouse cinema is that there were actually a great deal of really innovative filmmakers who came out of that. Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, and some others who sort of started there and got their kind of got going. Some people say Taxi Driver. You can definitely see the Grindhouse elements
sure.
in that film.
Yeah.
And there were some other really innovative filmmakers who just sort of stayed in the Grindhouse movement because they sort of recognized it as a interesting place to get away with making all sorts of great political statements without anybody ever questioning what they were doing. You know, the studios would say, you know, we need a movie with zombies. We need a movie with lots of sex and drugs. And they'd say, okay, yeah. And so they would insert all sorts of interesting political themes. And that's really what we're talking about. The quotation that I really like to park on is by George A. Romero, who directed Night of the Living Dead, which is one of the films we'll be screening.
And oh, really?
Yeah,
Night of the Living Dead.
The original
black and white.
Yeah, the original black and white.
Scary zombie movie.
Yeah. And he said that, he said that there's a lot of us filmmakers who are really disenfranchised because the 60s didn't work out the way that we wanted it to. So you've got all of these ex-hippies who... At the end of the 60s, they saw, you know, the Manson family murders, the assassination of Martin Luther King, and so they were very angry. The peace and love movement just didn't happen. And so they sort of utilized the idea of making these very angry, nihilistic horror films as a way of reflecting their disenchantment. And so in a lot of ways, these movies that we're going to be watching are kind of cries of despair.
Yeah, interesting way of looking at it. But they're also gore was a big element.
Gore was a big element.
Grindhouse stuff and all that stuff. There's all these kind of things that are continuing in today's big budget movies that really had the huge part of their start.
Yeah.
And Grindhouse. A couple of students here with you as well that I want to introduce. Cristiano, thanks so much for joining us as well.
No problem.
And Tyler.
How you doing?
Thanks, man. Thanks for coming in, you guys. Tell me a little bit about the student involvement in this and what's your role going to be as part of putting this whole thing on?
Well, I'm actually personally going to be doing the advertising mostly.
All right, cool.
Passing on flyers. You might see a couple around town.
All right. This is part of that. Promotion. Here
promotion.
You go.
Yeah, he's apparently put flyers up all over UAS. So
yes.
I told him he's got to take them down later. So
tell me, what's the themes of the flyers? Did you use some of the old movie poster kind of things, or did you create new stuff, or what'd you do?
Well, we just kind of... Maybe mashed a few of the pictures from the actual films and put a little quotes on top of them.
Quotes from the films.
Yeah.
So, like, there's one of Leatherface holding up a chainsaw, and it's got the quotation on the top is, "Our family's always been in meat."
Nice. Now, it must be one of them peppercorns. I always love that.
Yeah.
So, So would you consider Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Is that a Grindhouse movie?
Oh, yeah.
Is that
genre? Is the quintessential Grindhouse movie.
Because I almost thought that almost went mainstream in a way.
Well, you know, a lot of Grindhouse movies really did go mainstream. In fact, Night of the Living Dead is considered one of the most successful independent films of all time.
Yeah.
Just because it was made on the fly and it just made obscene amounts of money in drive-ins and in Grindhouse theaters.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. And Tyler, what's your role in this?
Well, this is part of it. Come down here and
sure.
kind of just advertise it, put it out there. If anyone was curious about what their English 111 class is doing at their local college, this would be a fun experience for them to appreciate what we have the opportunity to do here is really go back into some of the important parts of our culture and aspects of it. And really, that'd be like pulp culture and movies and the stories. Now they can reflect that. And this would be a good opportunity to see more than just, you know, a horror movie.
Yeah, so talk to me a little bit about that. How is this then instructive for an English class to watch the Grindhouse movie?
Right. Well, the thing that I've really tried to drive home for my English 111 class is the agenda of storytelling. Every story has an agenda, and every story sprang from something. You know, there's a foundation. There's a motivation that every author tries to address. Like, we just read Frankenstein, and we talked about how this was really a response to the French Revolution. And so, just like I believe Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Night of the Living Dead are a response to the Vietnam War, to the civil rights movements. And so this is just really giving them a perspective of, you know, not just looking at a piece of cinema or literature and saying, you know, well, that was fun.
Yeah.
But really trying to dig deep and understand the roots and the origins and what motivates the filmmaker or the author, just to give them a wider world view of why we tell stories. You know, what did the authors believe in, and why did they believe it?
Yeah, wow, fascinating way of looking at it. All right, Christiana, I'm going to give you the opportunity. Tell us when and where. How do people get to it? How do people buy tickets? All that stuff. Go.
All right. Well, it's at the Egan Building, and it's at the lecture hall, actually. You'll find it on Saturday, and I think it starts at 3?
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock.
Free to public.
Free.
Free.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Free to public. There you go. Now, just as a quick side note, is that Night of the Living Dead, is that public domain?
Yeah, it's public domain.
That's that funny thing where they let that lapse, right?
Romero forgot to put the copyright on it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is funny because when you watch Dawn of the Dead, the sequel, the copyright is huge on the opening screen.
We own this
one. He was a little angry about that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thanks, guys. Once again, that's Grindhouse. It's happening Saturday at 3. It's out at the UAS Lecture Hall, out at the Egan Lecture Hall at UAS. So Tyler, Cristiano, and Danelle, thanks so much for
coming. Thank you.
Yeah. We appreciate it.
Yeah, come by. Everyone.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a little song called The Salmon Dance, and we've got a person in the studio with us right now, Bob Tkach, who's going to be talking about, as part of the JWAC speaker, he's going to be talking about international politics of seafood eco-labeling and sustainability certification. Wow, that's a mouthful. Tell me about it, Bob Tkach.
Oh, it's not really too complicated. It just has to do with the future of Alaska salmon and other seafood industries and what may or may not be safe for you to buy or know you're buying at grocery stores for the rest of your life.
So it sounds pretty important. So this is really just how stuff is labeled, how stuff is marketed and labeled. Is that kind of the right? Is it just on the retail end, or is this all the way through the process?
Well, it's all tied together, but it comes down to eco-labeling, which are those little labels of one kind or another. You remember the dolphin-free labels on tuna cans, for instance?
Yep.
Those were one of the first ones in the United States. But actually, eco-labels have been around since 1978. Germany started the first one called Blue Angel, which I'm not exactly sure what it certified, but I think it was a general retail product certification. Since then, according to, of course,
organic labeling and things like that are these things that enter in that I think of when I think about food labeling.
Yeah, they're all similar.
Right,
eco-labeling in this case is, you know, fairly specific to seafood or food products, dairy products. But then you have a fair trade coffee, for instance, or the Stewardship Council, which certifies that whatever wood item carries their label, it comes from a sustainably managed forest.
So something that says wild salmon or Alaska the wild salmon on it, is that an eco label? Or is that, what is that?
Well, it depends who you ask.
Okay.
The eco labeling world has gotten.
This is kind of the crux of what you're talking about, somewhat, right?
Yeah, it's gotten very confusing over time. The Marine Stewardship Council is probably the world's best known seafood eco labeler. They have those little round blue and white labels on seafood packages. If you go down to Walmart, in fact, you can find a wild Alaska salmon with or without the MSC label on it. ASME's.
Now, how does it? What's the determination? Why? How would two essentially identical packages end up one with the label and one without?
I'm not exactly sure.
Okay.
If you are a client, which is what the MSC Marine Stewardship Council calls the partners it works with, then that means you've gone through their auditing process, and your seafood product comes from a sustainably managed fishery of some sort.
I see.
After you get certified with that, if you want to put the label on your product, you actually have to pay them a per unit fee. So you pay your certification and auditing costs, and then the certification fee. In some cases, retailers just want to know that your seafood comes from a safe place. They don't want your or anybody's other label on their product, because more and more, as we've seen at Fred Meyer's and all over the place, bigger retailers are going to house brands.
Right.
The trend is that they want you to trust their store as a good place to shop, whether you're coming in for electronics or seafood or dog food or milk or anything like that. So they don't
want Kirkland's signature for the Costco brand. You know, that's the internal brand. Even though they're getting those products from other places, they're kind of sort of they're making those their own brand.
Yeah, it's called private label brands, essentially.
Right.
Alaska, through Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, has really established the Alaska brand. It's one of the most well-known brands in the United States. We rank up there, like, just behind when ASME does these surveys. Alaska Seafood is, like, second or third after Oreo cookies and the Beef Council.
So, wow.
You know, and if you get cookies and salmon, what else do you need?
Right. That's a full meal right there.
But on the other hand, the Alaska Diamond is only a product origin label. It tells you that this is Alaska seafood. It comes from a legally harvested, or it's a legally harvested product from a legitimate fishery somewhere in Alaska. That doesn't tell you, it doesn't claim to tell you anything else, and mostly people read into these things. The MSC label, for example, says this is a sustainably this is a sustainable product. The package you bought with that label is a sustainable product. But it doesn't address the product. It addresses the management form. They'll go back and review fisheries in Alaska up until this last year anyway. Salmon fisheries and other ones, or they'll go to Australia, all over the world. MSC has certified products. But they certify the process. They don't certify the product itself.
Mm-hmm.
There's a label in France, La Belle Rouge, that's been around for about 45 years. The French government started it after a poultry scandal back then. They wanted consumers to know they were getting safe food. They certify, being French and concerned with French cuisine, they certify the product. So if you buy a piece of fish in France that's got the La Belle Rouge on it, label on it, you know that it's healthy and safe and a top quality product. Whether it was caught legally, whether it came from a fishery that's been overfished, they don't address that question. I don't know that how much of that French consumers know. I'm sure American consumers, who generally don't pay any attention at all to eco labels, would probably not pay that much attention.
So when you dive into this issue, is it just a mess, or do you think that's kind of done in a way that makes sense, or is there, you know, is there an issue here as far as like, hey, we don't, what consumers don't realize is that they're not getting this or this or this. Is that what's going? Is that part of what's happening?
It is a mess, which has generally happened because eco labels arose by themselves, in large part in response to poor management of fisheries or forest or any of those products, or unsafe electronics or home products that contain, you know, kids' toys with lead paint on them, all those kind of things. So they all kind of rose up independently in their respective product areas. And now...
Or because of some public outcry like the dolphin thing.
Sure.
And so there became this dolphin label because it wasn't a governing or government mandated thing. It was just something that that companies were doing because they saw a market for that. Like, we're going to show that this doesn't kill dolphins when you're eating this tuna, and that's going to market our product.
Companies picked up on that demand, which largely came, I probably started from consumers or NGO groups or environmental groups.
I see. Okay.
But over time, they've all developed. There is an organization called the Ecolabel Index. They publish the Ecolabel News and claim to be the world's largest directory of ecolabels. And they say they track 432 ecolabels in 246 countries addressing 25 different industry sectors. Only one of those is seafood. So this uncontrolled rise of ecolabels has turned into a really confusing mess for people. You know, if you wanted to put all the ecolabels possible on a product, you probably wouldn't have any room for the brand name.
That's what I was just going to ask. Yeah. Have you ever done a count of how many labels could be on one piece of fish?
Depends on how big a piece of fish.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. So.
There is just starting an effort to bring some clarity to this situation, at least in the realm of seafood. It's called the Global Sustainable Seafood Initiative. It was first started by a German government research organization. They did the same thing, probably 8 or 9 years ago for a different kind of issue that worked out really well. And the GSSI, Global Sustainable Seafood Initiative, is intended to set a benchmark for eco-labeling. And if your eco-label meets these criteria, it will be considered legitimate. If it doesn't, then it won't. And presumably, retailers won't employ you anymore, and customers won't give it any credence if they happen to see it, if it still appears on a product.
Well, fascinating stuff. The Juneau World Affairs Council is having you speak, and that's happening tonight at 5 o'clock at the Jack Gallery Room. Is that right?
I believe they moved us back over here somewhere.
Oh, we're over back in K2? Is that right? Okay. Do you know? I don't know.
I was told the conference room at 5 o'clock.
Okay. Conference room at KTOO at 5 o'clock is where this is going to be. Once again, it's Bob Tkach, and he's going to be speaking about what we've just been talking about, this eco-labeling and sustainability certification.
I could add one more
thing.
The reason why this is really important to Alaska, specifically for salmon. We all hear about all the millions of salmon or millions of tons of salmon that are caught here every year, but actually Alaska only produces about 12% of the world salmon supply between wild and farm salmon. So the fact that Alaska has this brand name is very important. What Alaska producers have seen, particularly on salmon over the last few years, especially in Germany and the United Kingdom, where the MSC label is the most popular, is that people are asking for MSC salmon. And they're seeing products with a brand name on it, with the MSC label, but no indication that it comes from Alaska. So if all the and there's a sister organization to the MSC called the ASC, Aquaculture Stewardship Council, and they're going to start certifying aquaculture product. Presumably all the farm salmon producers in the world are going to ask for this stuff.
I see.
So if people start asking for MSC salmon, our 12% of the world supply is just going to happen to be the most expensive, and your average consumer is not going to look for Alaska salmon anymore. So it's a fairly critical threat to the future of the Alaska salmon industry.
All right. I'm talking about it more tonight at the KTOO conference room at 5 o'clock. Bob Tkach. Bob, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 17th of October, 2012. It's the birthday of Shinichi Suzuki, born in Nagoya, Japan, 1898, who gave us the Suzuki violin method, teaching children to play classical music by listening and imitating as they imitate speech. It's the birthday of Arthur Miller, New York City, 1915. His father was the wealthy owner of a coat factory. Family had a big apartment, a chauffeur, summer home at the beach, and then lost everything in the stock market crash of 1929. Had to move to a poor section of Brooklyn, into a six-room clapboard house where Miller had to share a bedroom with his grandfather. His uncle on his mother's side, Manny Newman, lived in the neighborhood. Uncle Manny was a salesman. He was a big talker, had big schemes for the future, even though he was struggling to make ends meet. Miller got involved in drama when he was in college, wrote a play, All My Sons, 1947, and just before the Broadway premiere, he went to an advanced performance in Boston, standing outside the theater, looked up and saw his uncle Manny, whom he had not seen in years, realized that Manny was on a business trip to Boston. He'd come to the play on a whim. Arthur Miller said, I could imagine his grim hotel room, the long trip up from New York in his little car, the hopeless hope of the day's business. And a year later, Miller learned that his Uncle Manny had committed suicide. He decided he had to write a play based on his uncle's life. He talked to Manny's two sons, interviewed them, and then holed up in a tiny cabin in Connecticut and sat down and wrote Death of a Salesman, produced in 1949. In the last scene of the play at Willie Loman's funeral, one of the characters says, for a salesman, there is no rock bottom to the life. He don't put a bolt to a nut. He don't tell you the law or give you medicine. He's a man way out there in the blue, riding on a smile and a shoeshine. And when they start not smiling back, that's an earthquake. A salesman is got to dream, boy. It comes with the territory. It's the birthday of Nathaniel West, born New York City in 1904. He was managing a hotel in New York City when he met a woman who wrote an advice column for the newspaper. She showed him a few of the letters she'd gotten from readers. She thought they were funny. Nathaniel West thought they were heartbreaking. And he wrote his first novel, Miss Lonely Hearts, about an advice columnist. Later, having moved to Hollywood, he wrote his novel, The Day of the Locust. And it's the birthday of Jimmy Breslin, Jamaica, New York, 1930. Newspaper man, novelist. Latest book is Branch Rickey, about the manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who integrated Major League Baseball. Jimmy Breslin, who said, newspaper men don't go to bars anymore. They go to health clubs and then go home. They're in fantastic health, but they wish they were in the bar, and their wives wish they were in the bar, too. Here are two little poems for today, two limericks written by Robert Frost in 1898. He was 24. There was a man went for to harm a quiet but human old farmer. Now he wishes he'd known to let folks alone, for this is the doctrine of karma. There was a young poet who tried making boxes when preoccupied. One day he made one, and when he got done, he had nailed himself on the inside. Two limericks by Robert Frost from the collected poems of Robert Frost, published by Library of America. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Writer's Almanac there with Garrison Keillor, and we are, this is Wildlife Wednesdays. It's an exciting day, isn't it, Tina
it
Brown?
Is exciting.
In the studio with me. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you? Thank
I'm doing
you for
great.
Having us down here. Tonight's presentation is going to be awesome.
Yeah, we've got a room full of folks here. Kate Savage is here. Kate, so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Ron Ateya is here as well. Thank
Hi,
you, Ron.
Amy.
And you are both with Noah. And Ron, you're a criminal investigator at Noah. And you were just saying that you kind of deal in the area a lot of where there's reports of harassment of marine mammals and that sort of thing?
Right. So the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement is charged with investigating reports of complaints of harassment, takes, things of that nature. So we, as you can imagine, we get a lot of reports throughout the summer season where people see things that they think might be a violation. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. We investigate nearly every one of the reports that we get. Of course, we investigate every report of a dead marine mammal. We would like to prevent death. So we spend a lot of time doing things like this, doing outreach, trying to educate the general public on, you know, what is acceptable behavior around marine mammals.
And Kate, when there is a report of a dead animal, that's often a time when you get involved as well.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes,
so
indeed,
tell me
yeah.
a little bit about your function and what you do.
Well, in each of the NIMS regions, there's what we call stranding networks. And those are groups of volunteers, usually within the marine mammal community, that are authorized to respond to strandings. And so, you know, if there's a dead or injured marine mammal or an entangled whale, then we'll get a call and we'll go out and find out what's going on.
Yeah, and this is for whales and seals, sea lions, anything I'm missing there? Or, of course,
nope.
Orcas and
porpoises.
All the
the
whale
whole gamut.
All of that as well. And Tina, tell me a little bit about how you see the talk happening tonight and what's going to be happening on this Wildlife Wednesdays that's happening tonight.
Well, we should let everybody know it's 7 o'clock tonight at the UAS Glacier View Room, and that's Egan 221. It's right above the Egan Lecture Hall and just down from the library. And there'll be a brief welcome and introduction, and then Ron and Kate are going to take over and tell us all about the mysterious MMPA. Afterwards, we'll have more conversation.
Marine Mammal Protection Act.
Yes.
So that's and that's something you guys obviously deal with in every single day.
Yes, we do.
I mean, that is the parameters of what you guys are doing.
Yep.
So tell me about when there's a stranding of a whale. You find the carcass if it's a dead whale. What do you have to go about doing? What happens?
Well, you know, I'll tell you. I'll kind of go full circle.
Sure.
Actually.
Yeah.
We'll get a call, and people might call, Fish and Game, or NOAA Enforcement, or maybe even the Coast Guard, or they might call our hotline, our stranding hotline, and the number is 877-925-7773. For everyone that's listening. So we'll get a call and we'll go out to maybe the injured or the dead animal. And if we have to, we'll do a necropsy on the beach. And a necropsy is basically an animal version of an autopsy, just to find out basically the cause of death.
Is there a typical thing you're looking for in a necropsy? Is it all depending on the situation that you find the animal in? Or are there kind of top five things that are usually the things that have happened? Or, you know, How do you approach it, this massive animal, and then you've got to dive in there?
Yeah. Kind of like that. CSI. That's right. Yeah. But
you
thing
dust
is,
for fingerprints
yeah,
first, and
but your victim obviously can't talk either, and that's kind of a challenge.
Yeah.
But so you know, you try and find out what was wrong on kind of a gross level or just like whatever you can see, and then we'll take a lot of tissue samples and send those off to see what's going on microscopically. So. Hopefully, between all the different things that we do, we can come up with a solution for why the animal died. And, you know, sometimes, well, actually, quite often, it's difficult to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Is there a top sort of reason that you know, sort of just over the past few years seems like the number one thing that is happening? Is it natural? Is there boat collisions? Is it mystery beachings or, you know?
Well, you know, certainly as, say, for example, humpback whale populations have increased, then there's kind of more interaction between, you know, human activity and the whales. And so whatever information we collect hopefully can be used for coming up with solutions where we can all kind of peacefully coexist in the ocean.
Right. So. And, Ron, that is getting into a little bit of the area that you get into. People see things where they think, this doesn't seem right, the way something's happening. With a marine mammal, what kind of reports are you typically getting?
Yeah, that's correct. We'll often get reports from somebody, a boater or whatever, and they'll see something that they think might be a violation. A boat gets too close to a harbor seal that's on ice and maybe disturb it and run the harbor seal off of the ice floe, or an aircraft might buzz a pod of whales or something of that nature. So we'll follow up on those. We also work closely with Kate and her group when they're doing necropsies. You know, we have an interest there as well. Oftentimes we'll accompany and assist with the necropsy because, you know, let's face it, sometimes unlawful takes do occur. Sometimes we'll find bullets in animals. Sometimes we'll find arrows. Sometimes there'll be a whale that, you know, appears that it may have been killed from blunt force trauma. So we'll be there. We'll assist when we can. If there's evidence that needs to be collected, we'll gather that evidence. We'll document it. And if it's something that we can use later, hopefully for a prosecution, we'll do that as well.
But there's no incentive. It, you know, this reminds me of the poaching kind of stuff that, like, you hear happens with elephants in Africa, right? But there's an incentive there. There's ivory. Is there any incentive whatsoever for people to interact or to do harm to whales in Southeast Alaska? I can't think of it.
No, I don't think. I think usually it's certainly not intentional.
It's either not intentional or it's someone just being a real jerk.
I think oftentimes we'll find, say, a harbor seal that may have a bullet in it. And oftentimes it's the result of a lawful take from an Alaskan native who's out hunting seals. But for whatever reason, the seal got away before they were able to recover the carcass. And I think that's actually fairly common.
I see. Okay. So that's one thing that can come up.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. So and then you're going to talk a little bit about the Marine Mammal Protection Act as well. What kind of stuff are you going to touch on there?
Oh, you know, hopefully in an interesting fashion, just, you know, how it's organized and the history of the MMPA. And, you know, in Alaska, or certainly in Southeast Alaska, we are interacting with marine mammals all the time. So it's good for people to know what they can and they can't do, and what's important to make sure the population stays healthy.
Yeah. I was telling you before we went on, Mike, that just I have friends that work in the kind of tourism industry in the summers, and it's they report that there's a lot more boat activity just in the past couple of years. Is that something that you are noticing? Just that the interest in watching bubble feeding and watching that sort of stuff has grown so intensively, and there's such an economic pressure to bring people out there that it seems to push people towards closer and closer interaction with the animals.
I don't think we have any hard data on the numbers of vessels, but my impression is that there are more vessels out there engaged in wildlife viewing, particularly in the last 5 years or so. So we do get calls. We have a separate number than the stranding hotline. Our violation number is 800-853-1964. We get calls from people that are on the water, you know, hey, I'm out here right now. I see this going on right now. What do you want me to do? And, of course, our instructions are take video, take pictures. Here's my email address. Here's my cell phone number. If it's near town, we'll head out that way immediately. Those are the sorts of things that we like to hear from the general public. It's not always a violation, but it's better for us to get out there and make the determination than to not welcome those calls.
Yeah, and do you have advice for people that might see an animal that either seems like it's in trouble or is stranded, that sort of thing? Call that hotline number, but is there things that they can do while they're out there or things that they should not do while they're out there?
Well, I guess I would recommend that they don't approach the animal too closely. But certainly, calling either the hotline number or whatever number of any agency that they can find would be great, because eventually it'll be filtered to us, and the sooner the better. And we really, really appreciate people calling in, because, you know, the people walking the beach and on the boats, I mean, they're kind of our eyes on the water. And so, it's very, very helpful.
Well, great. Well, it's all happening tonight, part of Wildlife Wednesdays. You'll be able to hear these speakers, Kate Savage and Ron Ataya, will be speaking on the mysterious MMPA, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and also be talking about some of the areas that they work in, both criminal investigation and also on strandings. Thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it. That's happening tonight at 7 o'clock at the UAS Glacier View Room out at the Egan Building on UAS. Wildlife Wednesdays.
Thank you so much. Always an exciting Wednesday.
Thanks, Tina. Yeah. That's freaky music by Heyoka. It's called Flying Dub Sauce, and that was in last year's TGR film. What was last year's called?
One for the Road.
One for the Road. And what's this one's called?
Dream Factory.
We've got Alaska Powder Descents in the studio with us right now, and thanks you guys for coming in. So we got the TGR Film Festival coming up. This is exciting.
Yeah, no doubt. It's the kickoff to winter. We've got the snow line coming down. Looks about 700 feet elevation right now, and tomorrow is Alaska Day. So how appropriate to show a couple of great flicks.
It's like a harmonic convergence all
Absolutely.
Happening at once, man. It's all coming together. So have you gotten a little bit of a preview of this one? Have you seen any of it at all?
I did. Okay. I watched them both a couple weeks ago. I
okay.
got the films early, and I couldn't hold back.
So there's two films.
There's two films.
So tell
it's
me about
be a double feature.
Yeah, tell me.
So we've got Dream Factory, which is TGR's regular film. And then Further, which I think everybody's absolutely excited about because it only comes out every couple years. And it's a backcountry-oriented snowboard film
okay.
done up by Jeremy Jones, who is, in my opinion, the best big mountain snowboarder in the world.
Wow, very cool. So tell me a little bit about this is a thing that comes out just once every couple of years? It's sort of a continuing series?
Yeah,
but
it's supposed to be a trilogy. So Jeremy Jones
okay.
got away from helicopters, started hiking mountains and doing mountaineering-type stuff with his snowboard. So the first film was called Deeper, and now we're at Further. And 2 years
from
now,
Deeper.
It'll be higher.
Yeah, yeah, I remember when Deeper came out. That's right. So that's right.
This is the continuation to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. So have you seen the films as well?
I haven't. I was working on the Further shoot.
Oh, okay.
So we were up finishing up the shoot this springtime up in the Wrangell Mountains. So I've been holding back. I've been waiting to see it on the big screen.
It's a little nerve-wracking, I'll bet, to see the work, right? You've put in a lot of hard hours.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I've just been seeing little teasers that TGR have been sending out to get people interested, but I think it's going to be really good from everything I've heard from some of the showings that have been going on down in the States. The reception has been really, really positive. So
cool.
I have high hopes.
Yeah, definitely. So tell me a little bit about what function you had for Further.
So I went on for the Further shoot as their guide. So I was there providing avalanche safety, just doing snowpack analysis, being their medic on set, and being their rope guy. So all of the Further film is snowboard mountaineering, basically. So there's quite a bit of rope work. Just getting on top of some of these lines is pretty technical. So I was there to just aid in the aid in the madness, I guess.
Was there stuff that they – I mean, the name of that film itself really is a promise that we're going to do stuff that's just never even been tried. Was that kind of what was happening out there?
You know, it's been a really cool sort of merging of sort of traditional mountaineering and big mountain riding. I think the two have finally really started to come together, and all the riders are really, really stepping up to some amazing terrain, really intense terrain that definitely took a lot of respect. So it was cool to see what everyone was sort of stepping up to and really pushing themselves to get on top of.
And we had an intense snow year last year, too. So, I mean, that must have provided pretty ample opportunities to go do crazy stuff, yeah.
Oh, a lot of good snow. We really lucked out on weather. We were on Glacier for, I think, 26 days, and we got an amazing amount of shooting done. So there's some really good lines in the film.
What are the areas you guys are concentrating on in that film for the part you did? What areas of the around here?
Yeah, so we spent about a month in Wrangell-San Elias National Park. We were sort of between Valdez and Cordova in the national park, about 80 to 100 miles inland from the ocean.
Yeah, cool. Well, tell me a little bit about Alaska Powder Descents. Just for people who don't know, fill me in on what you guys do and then why it is that you feel it's important to spend all this time and energy bringing in TGR films.
Yeah, absolutely. Alaska Powder Descents was founded in 2008. So we're entering our fifth season now, and it's been a wild ride, so to speak. We did it just as the economy was collapsing. Everybody's like, what are you thinking, right, starting a heli-ski company during this time? And I'll be darned if it hasn't been working out pretty good. We've gotten to meet all kinds of people from around the world, from Lafian groups to other European groups, people from New Zealand, Australia, just great like-minded people who are really into the mountains. And that's what it's all about for me. My main company is a summer operation that deals with your more typical type of tourism type stuff. So to get into the heli ski scene for 6 weeks at a time, beginning February 15th through about mid-April, it's just a really incredible thing to do, and a chance to meet pro caliber riders and be with the best kind of mountain people. And you know, I think more than anything, we just wanted good gear and to be able to heli ski around our area. We've got a 1.2 million acre permit, which is, I don't know, 1,000 Eagle Crests or 50,000. I don't know. Right. I got to do the math on that sometime. But it's a lot of terrain. There's a lifetime of stuff to explore out there.
Yeah.
And like the old North Face ad said, never stop exploring. And right, that's what it's all about for us.
So explain the niche that you guys have, though. You don't actually own helicopters, right? You're not a helicopter company. You provide, you're the guides, sort of. You're the tour guides in a way.
Yeah, we're the guides out there. And I don't think there's any operation in existence, maybe Canadian Mountain Holidays in Canada, but most of the helicopter companies, heli-ski companies, are guide-oriented, guide outfitters, and they contract with various helicopters. In Juneau, of course, we've got a lot of helicopters, so we're in a unique position to jump in an A-Star when the weather breaks and get out there after it. Whereas, you know, locations like Valdez and Cordova, they've got to bring the pilots in and the helicopters in, and it's a little bit more difficult. But, you know, here it was a natural choice to do. We've got the helis sitting here, and we've got a lot of great snowboarders and skiers in the area. So, I mean, our local clientele that I try to hook up as best I can is a big part of the motivation. Somebody said, you know, it's my civic duty to make this thing happen. So right, I've taken that and rode with it.
So tell me a little bit about how the relationship with TGR started and how you got to where now you're doing these premieres.
Sure, it's kind of wild because in the early to mid 90s, I started ski patrolling at Eagle Crest, and that's about when Teton Gravity Research started releasing their films. So, you know, for years and years and years, I just watched these athletes
like
and
we
watched
all do. Yeah, right.
TGR
yeah.
progress and do these amazing things. And when we started this heli ski operation, all of a sudden we were put on the industry map. And we got to meet Steve Jones, Todd Jones, Jeremy Jones. The Jones brothers are all Teton Gravity Research. And we're also really good friends with Ryland Bell, who is Jeremy Jones' main backcountry partner throughout the year, and he's also one of the stars of the Alaska segment in Further. And so when you know people like that, it attracts more people. And we've just had all kinds of pros come through here. And Teton Gravity Research comes to Alaska every year. They started originally as fishermen in Southeast Alaska and were attracted to the mountains, and then Valdez started kicking off heli skiing, and during that time they were a big part of what was happening there, and eventually got their company going and have been coming back to Alaska ever since. So there's only so many operators in Alaska, and now we're on the map and a natural stopping place for them to come and hang out.
Yeah, well, it's and the films that they make are just kind of next level.
Absolutely.
You know, they're just really, it's the absolute top pros out there doing absolutely amazing things. And then the filmmakers are incredible as well. So it's really a fun stuff. I'm going to be hosting it. I get to host it tomorrow night.
Yeah,
I'm excited.
That's great. You did an awesome job last year, so we're excited. It's better than me getting up there and talking, I'll tell you that much.
I don't know. Yeah, but no, it's going to be really fun. We're going to pack out the Jack tomorrow. It's happening tomorrow night. What's the time and all that stuff?
We've got a 5 p.m. for the under 21 crowd. Kids under 6 are free admission. It's a double feature. It's actually a double feature, which is kind of crazy.
It's quadruple feature.
So Dream Factory will play first right at 5, and then Further right after that. We'll try to condense that early show as much as possible. And then the second showing will begin at 8 p.m., and that's when we can kind of take a little bit more time to talk and yell at people and get a little more rowdy. There's going to be an open – no. I shouldn't say open,
but not open.
There's going to be a beer and wine garden there.
Yes.
I made the mistake of saying that on Facebook yesterday, and some people called me out on it. So, yeah, Rendezvous is putting that on, and we've got all kinds of great companies that, you know, all the cool kid companies are coming out and donating swag.
Sure.
And it's going to be a lot of fun.
Very good. All right. Well, it's happening tomorrow night. It's Alaska Powder Descents presenting the TGR film premiere of these two great movies, Further and
Dream Factory.
And Dream Factory. Starts tomorrow night. The kiddie show, the family-friendly show, starts at 5, and the other show starts at 7?
At 8 p.m.
Yeah. So 5 and 8 are the two times.
We're probably going to be finishing up around midnight, 1. We'll see whenever the jack kicks us out.
All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you got it.
Thank you.
Support comes from the Juneau Empire, celebrating a century in Juneau. More information on Facebook, in print, or JuneauEmpire.com on the anniversary festivities for the Juneau Empire.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
And that's a Juneau afternoon for today. I'd like to thank all my guests for joining me. There's going to be snow tonight, accumulation up to an inch, but it should wash away tomorrow. Going to join NPR with headlines coming up next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear.